Every now and then, someone passes through your life, and even if you don't stay in touch, they leave a big impression. That happened to me with Ron Strickland. He's one of America's great hikers and campaigners, and much of what we'll talk about here is from his memoir. Its title is Ron's Trail Name, Pathfinder. I know most of you are listening in the UK, and although Ron's work has been mainly in North America, he has managed to achieve something quite enviable, to live most of his life doing what he loves, hiking. How he managed that, I hope to find out. His great contribution to outdoor life has been the creation of a true national scenic trail called the Pacific Northwest Trail, the PNT for short. That creation is no simple matter, requiring the United States Congress to call it into being. He's also proposed another trail that runs from sea to sea, almost 8,000 miles long, and it has been hiked, although it's yet to bear any official designation. I spoke to Ron over a scratchy Zoom call from where he now lives and hikes with his wife Tina on the island of Hawaii. Initially, it does sound odd, but you'll quickly tune into the audio quality. We spoke one day after his 80th birthday, and we took a stroll through his hiking career.
Well, I actually grew up in the state of Rhode Island, which your audience may know, is the smallest possible American state. My grandparents were all from Yorkshire. We lived in the countryside, and I was one of those little boys who liked to fool around in the little rabbit trails out behind the house. Noon recess would be out along the mill pond, making little trails and exploring. So right from my infancy, I was very keen on that. When I was a student at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., I started going out on backpacking trips with a group called the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club. And I just fell in love with everything about the Appalachian Trail, with the maps. It was love at first sight for this, the whole thing. And none of my fellow students knew anything about this. They were very cosmopolitan. In addition to that, I had a friend at home there named Paris Walters, who's also mentioned in my memoir. He talked to me all the time about the joys of hiking the long trail in Vermont. That's a trail you may know, the length of Vermont, which is about, I think, 270 miles, about hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. He was a really big influence on my life in this respect.
Because you've made a life out of that hiking through your writing and photography. It has been something that it literally did shape the way you chose to live, didn't it?
You're absolutely correct. Yesterday at dinner, Tina presented me with a binder full of reminiscences from 80 people I've known throughout my life, and many of them were young people that I had inspired in the same way. Just as Paris Walters had inspired me, I inspired much younger people.
Wow.
In fact, somebody described me back in those early days as a Pied Piper of irresponsibility, that I was always talking about trips and inspiring other people, inspiring young people to think about the sort of vagabondish lifestyle.
Can you put into words the appeal of, as you call it, the vagabondish lifestyle?
Oh, it's always been the word freedom, if you want one word. Most people graduate from school and then they have a series of jobs and get a mortgage and children and die. What I wanted to do was to be out on the trail, heading toward the horizon, deciding exactly where I wanted to go. That was it, freedom. Are you buying that?
Naturally enough, I met Ron on a trail. In 2002, I was hiking the Pacific Crest Trail with Liz, and we have a podcast series all about that six-month-long through hike, as the Americans call it. Ron was hiking parts of the PCT, but was keen to tell me about the then little-known trail called the PNT, the Pacific Northwest Trail, which he had devised and to which he was writing the guidebook. So this part of our conversation is from 21 years ago.
Tell me about your book plans.
That sounds like a real interviewer's question, doesn't it? Tell me about your book you have planned.
That's the kind of question that authors always like to hear. Tell me about your book. Anyway, I'm delighted to tell you about that. It's a guidebook to the Pacific Northwest Trail, which is not this trail. We're on the Pacific Crest Trail. The Pacific Northwest Trail goes from east to west from the Continental Divide in Montana, near the Canadian border, all the way to the Pacific Ocean. So my book is a description of how to hike this 1,200-mile, very little-known, new trail.
In the intervening decades, the PNT has indeed become an established trail, Ron's great legacy to the hiking community. Because of the overwhelming popularity now of the Pacific Crest Trail, with hiker numbers risen from hundreds in our day to thousands now, I wondered whether his PNT had become the go-to trail for those seeking true wilderness.
That's a good question, and I would say yes, somewhat. But remember, all trails are not created equal because it's poorly marked, more difficult. Some places it's not an actual trail at all. So people might suddenly decide they want to hike Pacific Northwest Trail, but they better do some research and be in good shape.
So let's just explain where it goes. Now, let me try and do this kind of from memory. The three states in the top left-hand corner of the USA, if we were going from left to right, but you'll hike it in the opposite direction, I think they're Washington State, Idaho, and Montana. And the trail runs along the top of these states, close to the Canadian border. And it would normally be hiked from right to left through whole sets of mountains, from the Rocky Mountains in Montana right the way up to the coast. And this is all set out on the map on the website pnt.org. It's pretty hard to sum that up, a journey like that, in a few sentences, but what is the pitch for the PNT?
Its route is designed for scenery and adventure. And as you said, if you're going from Montana, it's Glacier National Park. Glacier National Park is one of the most beautiful places in North America. Fabulous scenery. Moore Ranges in northwest Montana, Idaho Panhandle has Moosell Mountains, Selkirk Mountains, into Washington State, Salmo Priest Wilderness, down to the coastal areas, some beautiful islands. And we actually cross a ferry from one island out to the Olympic Peninsula, and then cross the Olympic Mountains, and then a 30-mile pure wilderness beach to the northwesternmost point in the lower 48. The way I designed this was to have maximum scenery and adventure.
How difficult was it to get the idea of that trail into reality? Because it has to go through Congress or something, doesn't it?
This was extremely difficult. I thought of this brainstorm. I was a classic American kid hitchhiking around Europe. So classic that on the cover of Newsweek magazine in August 1969, they had a picture of some of us kids doing that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was also the height of the Vietnam War. The mentality of people younger than 30 was very anti-war very united in our age group. You know, we used to say, don't trust anybody over 30. It was that mentality. I learned from all that, plus the fact that I was doing my doctoral work on how to add new units to the National Wilderness System. I decided I would use what I was learning about that on how to add a new trail to the National Trail System, which itself was brand new. I decided that I would create such a thing, which meant that I had to get an act of Congress to authorize a study of the feasibility and desirability of having such an entity as Pacific Northwest Trail. So I started this idea in 1970. This finally was adopted by a second act of Congress in 2009. I told this to somebody the other day. It took me 40 years. This person was aghast. Had big eyes, you know, wow. In retrospect, what I was doing was crazy, but I had a tiger by the tail, you know, and couldn't let go.
Because it's full of twists and turns, that entire story. You've put, said just 40 years there, but there was an awful lot going on. Because first of all, it looked like it's going to happen. Then the federal study team more or less said, no, we don't think it should happen. You had a guerrilla trail for a while. And it's an amazing achievement to achieve that against so many bureaucratic, not just bureaucratic obstacles, people who were claiming to be environmentalists, against their obstacles as well. Because you're not just, I think it's important to point this out, you are not just linking existing trails. At times you were out there scouting entirely new routes. That must have been a massive challenge and required expertise you didn't have.
Now let me ask you a question. Don't you think that you would really enjoy that?
Well, I see what you mean. Yeah, okay.
Come on, you know you win.
Yeah, okay. but you would need to know someone, because I wouldn't know how to go out there with a theodolite, because all these trails, for them to be national trails, am I right in thinking they have to be at a certain gradient, a grade, you would say, to allow, I don't know, to pass as a trail?
You're jumping in. The first thing you have to know is that every inch of land is owned by somebody. In our case in the Northwest, because of the way the country developed, much of the land is owned by the federal government, and it's divided into national parks, national forests, wildlife refuges, etc. The tricky part out in the woods is being very good at route finding, maps. What I did initially was to go by myself for quite a few summers and figure this out on my own. But in 1983, there was a young fellow, 15 years younger than I was. I was 40 and he was 15. And he wrote in saying that he was a recent graduate in geology and map making, and could he volunteer? He couldn't believe how fast I had him out on the trail. We literally went out. We didn't know each other very well. We went out for 100 days. I had a manuscript, and he would make maps as we went along, fix the bad maps down. And that became our first published guidebook in 1984. So you're right. I needed to have somebody specialized in that. And I needed to have people specialized in all the other many aspects of doing this kind of work. So I was like kind of a director of putting it together.
Did the eventual PNT end up being close to the original plan that you had in your mind?
Yes, although it's always evolving. There are some places we still don't have an actual trend. It's always evolving. You know, the Appalachian Trail and the Crest Trail, for instance, it took many decades for the, you might say, fixed location to settle in.
Going back to our meeting 2 decades ago on the Pacific Crest Trail, I reminded Ron of his comments regarding hiker numbers.
And right now, in 2002 and for the next couple of years, will be considered in future decades as the classic time on the Pacific Crest Trail, because now the infrastructure is perfect, the trail tread is excellent, there are signs and blazes, there's a developed network of trail angels, the people who help us hikers along the way by putting water out and taking us into the houses. Right now is the absolute classic time because of all of those things and because it's not overcrowded. Mm-hmm. Notice we've seen very few people, and this is the very best time of year to start out.
Do you think it will get more crowded?
Oh, absolutely. Just like in the UK, a lot of trails are crowded, or even the Appalachian Trail now, there's I don't know if this is really true, but I've heard there are 2,000 or 3,000 people start out in the spring in Georgia going, north to Maine.
Did Bill Bryson's book help that?
Yeah, Bryson's A Walk in the Woods made the Appalachian Trail more popular, even at the expense of making fun of all the things I hold dear.
And it was another book that massively increased hiker numbers on the PCT. Wild by Cheryl Strayed went on to become a Hollywood movie.
I was walking through the San Francisco airport one day, and I was looking at magazines and books to get, and there was Vogue magazine. The top of Vogue magazine, it said something about Pacific Crest Trail. You know, we didn't use to associate women's magazines, with trails. And boy, that set off a fantastic amount of interest in the Chris Trail.
Wow, Vogue. Wasn't it because it was picked by Oprah Winfrey's book club, I think? That might have been why it ended up with Vogue.
Yes, exactly. The bottom line with all of these trail subjects is they only exist if the public is behind them. And all of that interest that Cheryl Strayed generated was extremely valuable. And like you said, the Crest Trail has improved a lot since you were there. In fact, just now, there are some people in Japan who hiked our Pacific Northwest Trail 1 or 2 years ago. I'm talking with them about finding a publisher in Japan for a translation of Pathfinder. I would love to have a line of Japanese hikers come to hike our trail.
Not too long ago, I watched you put on your coat. You said let you cool, now I'm sorry, but I got to go.
The vagabondish lifestyle and freedom Ron described earlier came at a price. He says as much in his memoir that it was not emotionally cost-free. I hoped he wouldn't mind going into more details about those costs.
Well, looking back from the age of 80 to all those decades when I was so footloose and always very involved with finding new routes for trails or lobbying in Washington, D.C. for trails or the whole thing. There was definitely an emotional toll. I am the first to say that that was true. And as you may have noticed in Pathfinder, in 2005, I found a really good partner, Christine W. Hartman. We've been together ever since. You know, going through life, there's stages for life, famously. I'm far from the Ron Strickland of 1970 when I brought this whole project up.
But back then, you were living frugally, but I just wondered how you, whether your books and writing gave you enough to put boots on your feet and your mix of veggies in that battered cook pot.
Well, it was very frugal and very difficult. I was also a freelance writer. You know, I earned royalties from my books. I got equipment companies to donate equipment. Very frugal. As one of my old timers in my oral history book said, I was taking it out of my own hide, you know, what I was doing. So I don't really recommend to people to be that frugal, but I am a New Englander. Maybe you don't know, but New Englanders are famously extremely frugal.
I kind of wonder the sacrifices that someone makes for that freedom. You know, the line in that song, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose.
Well, what can I say?
I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable, Ron. It was just something I just wondered if you wanted to explore. Because
I have an answer.
Okay.
Here's my answer. I woke up yesterday, opened my eyes. I am 80 years old. You old son of a gun, you are 80 years old. What do I feel about that? I feel thanks. I also feel amazed that I got this far. I'm very thankful. Thankful for all those times bucking the brush, working out the roots. There were many hard times, but I put that aside. I think in the book I described what it's like to lay out a new section. We haven't talked about that yet. You know, physically build some new part.
Well, go
I'm
ahead.
Happy to discuss that.
Go on. Talk to me about it.
I mentioned before that every inch of every place is owned by somebody. There was a lot of opposition in the early days to the Pacific Northwest Trail. Some of my buddies and I decided that we had better make a demonstration area, a demonstration section of trail that we could do for free. So we found that the state of Washington had access to salt water about 2 hours north of Seattle. We got permission from them to make what they called a scratch trail, meaning like a deer trail, across that and down to the salt water. So I recruited somebody who was then a 70-year-old chief of a Boy Scout camp at Mount Rainier, who had learned trail design and building during the Great Depression and the Civilian Conservation Corps. And so he and I set out to this place that I've just been telling you about. He had been a draftsman at Boeing during the war. He was famous, he said, as the engineer who designed the Crapper and the B-17. So he, very colorful character, Max Eckenberg. So we had this 110-foot long surveyor stake, and he would crash ahead through the brush, pulling one end, following a compass course that he'd derive from his maps. And I would tail along behind, and then we'd mark azimuths in his notebook. And would be laying out the routes to fit the contours and that steep area going down to saltwater. So this involved camping overnight out there with our tools. We'd sleep under a tarp, often at the end of one of these days, bucking the brush. My legs and arms would just be covered with bleeding scratches. But we totally love this. Think about it now. I would love to do it again. See, I'm trying to persuade you.
Yeah, I listen. I'm 64 now, so maybe not. I was digging drains for the last few days, and that was enough, to be honest with you. And yet, in the middle of this lifestyle that you've painted, the writing, the living outdoors, the nomadic lifestyle, this hard work that you're doing on the trail, in the middle of this, you took a year off hiking to be the carer of a girl called Meadow Bloom from Alaska, where you'd been living to complete your book on the Alaskans. And you took her to as a live-in carer to Seattle for her advanced leukemia care. And even harder, she's had special needs. She had Down syndrome, autism, forms of retardation. She wore nappies, diapers in US parlance. And she was at the time using a wheelchair. I just found this sat like an island for me in the middle of this story. You got on great with that woman. I wonder.
She wasn't so much a woman. She was 15 years old.
Okay.
Person who could not speak, who was, unique.
I kept asking myself who had the biggest impact on whom there, because you certainly influenced her life, but I just wondered how much it changed you, that whole experience. It must have done so.
It did. Well, the backstory here is that I was married 7 or 8 years initially. My then wife was eager to have kids, but I was not much of a family person. I was focused more on the horizon, you know, out there in the brush.
Oh yes.
This may sound a little funny, but that is the way it was anyway. So after that, kids, I just didn't want to do that.
I'm amazed you said yes to this.
The thing was, I had also wanted for many years to do something very altruistic, especially at the Christmas holidays. And I had a friend in Anchorage, and she was working at a nonprofit group called Hope Cottages, and they couldn't find anybody to go to Seattle to take care of they called a special needs child. Now, I wanted to go to Seattle anyway, because Meadow Bloom had that list of, as they say now, challenges, deficits, that it's very hard to imagine one person would have. But on the other hand, it introduced me to a completely new lifestyle. She and I were living in a room, something called the Ronald McDonald House, which was a foundation that had to do with McDonald's food chain. Everybody who was living in that Ronald McDonald House had a child with cancer. I was living there as a sort of stand-in parent for such a child. And, you know, I really took to these other families. They loved me. And, you know, I like to do oral history. So pretty soon I was interviewing all of them about their challenges. I did write a book about that. It hasn't been published yet. I took very good pictures of all of them and their kids. And Meadow Bloom herself, she fit right into my little universe of trail volunteers. Before you knew it, she was out on our construction sites. She would be sitting and she sat in a chair that they brought for her. And she had a little harmonica. She could only blow one note, but she'd blow that one note, serenade us while we were working, digging the trail, using the chainsaw, etc. And everybody in our group, a trail group, adopted Meadow Bloom, just was accepted. I accepted it. Everybody accepted it. Your question is, how did that change me? That changed me a lot. I spent a whole year doing this, as it turned out, and became not a child skeptic, but I was embraced by all the kids at the Ronald McDonald House, besides Meadow Bloom. Many of them died. This was harder than any of the trail work was, I have to say, because kids were there because they had really bad cancer and they're likely to die, you know, from bone marrow grafts, the whole shebang. But this was very difficult. So I was just a better person, honestly, as a result of doing this. And my voice is breaking up, remember it. Yeah. But I'm telling you the truth.
Well, if someone's listening to this and thinks, you know, I've heard some of the Peak Pacific Crest Trail stuff that Simon's done, but, it sounded really a bit busy. It's just not really the backcountry experience I'd want. Do you think that perhaps the PNT is something that they should look towards? Is it something they should spend time researching, just finding out about? And what would be, I'm going to say, what's the best way of doing that? But I think I know the answer will be buy my book.
Well, thank you for asking that question. That's a person who wants more solitude, but certainly research Pacific Northwest Trail. We have plenty of information at our website, pnt.org. There have been several videos. In fact, right now there's an excellent 50-part YouTube video. I may have sent you the link to that.
I think you did, actually. I'll make sure it's in the show notes.
Anybody who sees that, I think, will be quite inspired, but not in an overly romantic way. This gives the sweat and tears as well, the bugs, the cold.
How long would it take most people? You know, they say 6 months for the PCT.
I think nowadays, with the emphasis on going as fast as humanly possible, I would say 2 months. I was never that kind of person. I was always returning to the same place, checking details in the manuscript. But people today who just want to go as fast as possible, I would say 2 months. And the nice thing about it is that it's more manageable for the ordinary hiker. To hike the Crest Trail, Panhandle Divide Trail, or Appalachian Trail, that really is like a 6 months or more project, even more weather dependent. For instance, this year, there's been so much snow in the Sierra. I have no idea when hikers will be able to get through there. There's so much snow there that the roofs of buildings in Lake Tahoe are caving in. Pacific Northwest Trail, because it's 1,200 miles and not, say, 2,200 or 2,700 or 3,200 miles. It's doable for sure in the season, the summertime. You have to start, say, late June or early July. It depends when the snow is really melted out of the mountains in Montana. At the western end, in 1983, when Ted Hitzroth and I arrived in the Olympic Mountains, immediately we got into new snow and we woke up in the morning and covered with snow and our boots were frozen, totally solid. You know, it's big country, big weather, very changeable weather, especially now. So I would do a lot of research about this, get in the best shape you possibly can, talk with the people at our Pacific Northwest Trail Association, There are plenty of people who do this. They don't start with the other trails. They just go for it. So if you're up for it, I promise you, you will have an amazing time.
And let's face it, Ron Strickland should know. I ought to mention that 2 years after her Seattle treatment, Meadow Bloom's leukemia returned, and she wasn't strong enough to go through another round of treatment. Links to Ron's website, to the PNT, and the videos he mentioned are in the show notes, along with a link to buy me a virtual coffee, just as a small way of saying thanks for doing these podcasts, keeping them advert-free, and paying for the hosting costs. If you could leave a review wherever you get your podcasts, especially Apple Podcasts, that would be fantastic too. There's more at alwaysanotheradventure.com. I'm Simon Willis. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.